fairly familiar with what the Oregon Youth Authority does and the good work that they do. So at this point, why don't I just bring Director Jester up and Mr. Jackson, as well.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Jester, and I'm the director of the Oregon Youth Authority. I would like to thank you in advance for not only your ongoing support and guidance for the Youth Authority, but for the assistance that you've given us in preparing this presentation today. During the past 2 years, the Oregon Youth Authority has focused on youth safety, performance measures, and outcomes, the restoration of the continuum of services and sanctions which begin and end in Oregon's communities, with the Oregon Youth Authority having a slice of that responsibility in the middle, for adequate levels of custody for the highest risk youth, which is represented in the demand forecast, strengthen capacity of community providers, which effectively achieve positive outcomes in higher risk youth, and you'll see that in the demand forecast for community, provision for gender-specific services, evidence-based services for young women through the reopening of the Oak Creek Youth Correctional Facility in Albany, and strengthening partnerships and collaboration with juvenile departments, private providers, and victims. You will see these priorities embedded in the governor's recommended budget. The reinvestments in this population, which restore many of the reductions that occurred in 2003. At this time, if you turn to page 4 of the presentation document, the mission of the Oregon Youth Authority is to protect the public and reduce crime by holding youth offenders accountable, providing opportunities for reformation in safe environments. The statutory authority for the Oregon Youth Authority lies in ORS 420A. On page 5, the brief history of the Oregon Youth Authority. We talked about this in the overview that we presented in January before this committee, but just to remind folks, in 1995, then-Governor Roberts commissioned a task force to review the services of juvenile justice in the state of Oregon. That task force was chaired by then-Attorney General Kulongowski. After a year and engagement of over 700 participants, there were a series of findings and recommendations which were codified in Senate Bill 1 and the creation of the Oregon Youth Authority. The separation of these public safety services from then Children's Services Division and the Department of Human Resources. OYA became an agency serving youth offenders aged 12 to 25 who were committed both by the juvenile court and by the adult court for offenses that occurred prior to the 18th birthday of the offender. On page 6, we have presented a diagram that shows how youth come to the Oregon Youth Authority. And you will see, starting on the left-hand side, the box showing the referral source can be law enforcement, schools, parents, community agencies going to the juvenile department. There is a process of county intake, and that can then go to a formal diversion agreement. It can go to a formal petition to the juvenile court. That petition can either result in adjudication as a delinquent juvenile, or it can be waived to adult court. The bottom gray bar shows the pathway for Measure 11 offenders. If a young person under the age of 18 is charged with a Measure 11 offense, it automatically is heard in adult court. If found guilty, the offender is then committed to the Department of Corrections. If the offense occurred before the age of 18, they are then transferred to the Oregon Youth Authority for housing and for reformation services. The bars basically will show how a case moves through this system. There are a number of options at both the juvenile court level. There are options for commitment to the Oregon Youth Authority for purposes of probation. And from probation, there can be either a successful termination and or, if unsuccessful, there could be a commitment to OIA for the purposes of close custody placement. Looking at the last set of bars from the close custody placement, a youth offender could go to a transitional program, then out to parole, foster care, residential treatment, or independent living home placement. Or if they were in DOC's custody, they could be placed in community supervision through the county community corrections, or they could return to a DOC facility depending on their age. The importance of this chart relates to the case management structure, which I have up on a foam board. And the point I want to make to members is that there are approximately 20,000 juvenile offenders that are managed in the state of Oregon. Of the 20,000, 18,000 of those offenders are managed at the local level by juvenile departments through a series of sanctions and services at the local level. The highest-risk youth offenders are managed by the Oregon Youth Authority, and they are shown within the umbrella of the case management chart in the middle. And those are the youth that are either placed on probationary services for out-of-home care in residential or foster care. They are placed in our youth correctional facilities, or they complete youth correctional facilities and end up on parole supervision back in communities. This chart is on page 7. The governor's recommended budget, which is displayed at the bottom of this chart, shows the increase in the capacity that the governor has recommended for the Oregon Youth Authority. And that includes 73 under the Community Services Probation section, 73 additional beds of capacity. Under the Close Custody or OIA Facility section, the increase is 145 beds in secure custody. And this restores the graduated sanctions and helps balance the continuum, again, that is between the community and facilities, OIA, and then back out to community. On page 8, you will see the OIA organizational chart. We have facility services, which manage the 7 youth correctional facilities and the 4 transition programs. Community services, which include all of our out-of-home care placement, county diversion, juvenile crime prevention dollars, and youth gang service dollars, which are passed through to counties, as well as our parole and probation supervision. Program support at the bottom, which supports these 2 service delivery arms of the Youth Authority, includes the Director's Office, the Office of Minority Services, and other typical business functions. One I would like to point out to you is the Juvenile Justice Information System, commonly known as JJIS. This information system has 37 users. 36 of those are local county juvenile departments. The 37th is the Oregon Youth Authority. This system provides a database for all juvenile offenders in the state of Oregon. It is a seamless system where we can pull data, where we can do comparisons and analysis for what services youth offenders have received, what services have been effective or not. We can profile offenders. We provide regular reports to counties and other entities to examine the outcomes of the services and programs that they are managing. On page 9, the demographics of the population we serve, top left-hand, total population of the Oregon Youth Authority, 56% of the juvenile offenders that we manage in the Youth Authority are either on parole or probation services in communities. There are 16% of our services are provided to DOC offenders who have been transferred from the Department of Corrections, housed in our youth correctional facilities because they were either waived and or committed a Measure 11 offense. That offense occurred before their 18th birthday. They were transferred to us prior to their 20th birthday. 28% of the youth offenders and 28% are youth offenders in our facilities. Gender split 87% of the offenders that we manage in the Oregon Youth Authority are male, and 13% are female. Criminal offense, I'm looking at the bottom left-hand chart now. About a third of the offenders that we manage are committed for a sex offense. About 28% are property offenders, and 20% are person-to-person offenders. Current age, 93% of the youth offenders that are managed by Oregon Youth Authority, which includes our DOC transfers, 93% are under the age of 21. The OIA offender profile on page 10, we talked about this briefly during the overview, just a couple of points to remind members. There are some distinct differences between the male and female populations that we work with. Looking at the criminal activity, which is the top portion of this chart, you'll see that 39%, almost 4 out of 10 of the youth offenders that are male are committed for sex offenses. A mere 6% of females are committed for sex offenses. But when you look at person offenses, 16% males, twice that, 31% are females. And generally this would be behaviors of assault, which is a higher representation, obviously, of young women. Substance abuse and alcohol, males are committed for criminal offenses related to substance abuse and alcohol, 3%, four times that number females at 13%. The bottom of this page shows the offender profile and the social characteristics of this population. The males, 3/4, have alcohol and drug use or abuse. 93% of the young women fall in the same category. There is a much higher propensity on the part of our young women to self-medicate. Following line, you'll see 2/3 of the males are diagnosed with a mental health disorder. Young women, 3/4 are diagnosed with a mental health disorder when they come into the Oregon Youth Authority. Males, 1/3 have been sexually abused. Over half, 57% of the females that we provide services to have been sexually abused. On page 11, yesterday...
Just a moment, Director Chester. Senator Westland.
Bob, on the... Could you break down the mental health disorder? I mean, the category, the acuity of those mental health disorders. I mean, I don't need an answer right now. I mean, my real question is, you know, what percent of those kids are getting in there that have pretty severe mental health issues?
Mr. Chair, Senator Westland, absolutely, we can have that information. Every 2 years, the Oregon Youth Authority conducts what we call a gap analysis, and that gap analysis looks at every youth offender that we are providing services to, and we look at all the precipitating issues with that offender actually through a file search and through JGIS. And so we have that information very definitively, and we will have that for you.
Well, if you follow up, Mr. Chair, follow up. Then, I mean, you would also do an assessment when they get there and see what type of services they need, and you should have a pretty good idea of these mental health diagnoses. And I don't know where I draw the line in terms of, you know, what's severe and acute, but if you could get us some of that data, I think that would be helpful for the committee.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westland, absolutely. And I would call the committee's attention that these percentages exclude conduct disorder. So these would be youth that would not be identified as conduct disordered youth. But we will get that for you.
Yeah, well, you got a big chunk of kids coming in. You know, it's blend them 70%.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westland, absolutely.
Director Justice, so if I recall from my days as a social worker, conduct disorder is for a diagnosis for those up to the age of 18. Is that correct? And when people come into the system over 18, they would go directly to the adult system.
Mr. Chair, we do have youth that enter the system. DOC transfers can be transferred prior to the 20th birthday. So we have some that are 18 and 19 years of age that are transferred.
Right, but they would start in OIA before they got to 18 or 19.
Mr. Chair, their offense would need to have been committed prior to their 18th birthday, but they could actually, through the adjudication process, which sometimes takes time, they could actually be 19 years of age and come into DOC's custody and transfer to the Oregon Youth Authority.
My question then is that if conduct disorder is not one of your diagnoses, then I assume antisocial personality disorder would not also, which is the diagnosis for those over 18 often.
Mr. Chair, I will say that's correct and look for my clinical guidance, which agrees with me. Yes.
Good. Right. Thank you.
On page 11, I think we all benefited yesterday from the presentation of Dr. Latessa on evidence-based services, and the Oregon Youth Authority has made tremendous investment in the implementation of evidence-based services and really looking at what works in Oregon and how do we make these programs more effective in Oregon with the ultimate goal of no new crime and reducing recidivism. And so we have used Dr. Latessa. He has done training of our staff. He has helped us with the review of both our closed custody programs and our contracted programs, of which all have now been reviewed, and we will talk later about the outcome of those reviews. But on page 11, I have outlined for you really the process that the Oregon Youth Authority has gone through in the implementation of effective evidence-based programs. We started with assessing offender risk and needs by developing the Oregon Youth Authority risk need assessment, which is a modification of the tool that Dr. Latessa spoke about yesterday, which is a Washington risk need assessment instrument. And we took it and modified it to reflect Oregon law, some of the peculiarities that Oregon has in its system, to make it work for us. The next thing we did was began a system of targeting the treatment to the risk level of the individual youth offender, implementing evidence-based programs to meet those individual risk areas and criminogenic factors. We have been using cognitive behavior and social learning approaches in all of our treatment programs and our contracted treatment programs. We have trained our staff, and we have provided technical assistance to our contract providers in this area. We have focused on the ultimate goal, which is a reintegration, the transition of youth offenders back to their home communities. We have applied a system of quality control, which we'll speak to later, which also includes the key performance measurements, but a number of other instruments that we use to measure the effectiveness on an ongoing basis and controlling the quality of our programs. We have relied on the Correctional Program Checklist, which is the University of Cincinnati. Dr. Latessa has worked on this checklist. It was formerly known as the CPAI. Again, our programs and community programs have had this instrument and have worked very closely with us in terms of not only the results, but the individual program improvement that has resulted from the initial assessment survey of the program. And then always recognizing the specific cultural needs of offenders as we apply all of the above risk need assessment and programming of youth that come into our custody. On page 12, you will see the factors that drive the costs within the Oregon Youth Authority. The second bullet, the local court commitment and sentencing practice, that varies greatly across the state of Oregon and is driven in part by local community capacity. And as we refer back to the foam board, we have 18,000 youth offenders who have not penetrated the state system by and large because local communities have the resources, the services, and the sanctions to keep them from further penetration in the system. The 2,000 that have moved in, that is a judicial decision that is based on what the options alternatives are and the degree of risk that the offender presents at the community level. I was pleased to hear Dr. Latessa affirm yesterday that he believes that Oregon judges make good decisions in regard to the placement of youth coming in, or at least that's what I chose to hear from his presentation. Maybe others heard otherwise. The significant needs of offenders also are cost drivers for us. And I believe Senator Westland spoke to this with the mental health issues of youth that come into our system, and that's one of the cost drivers. Sex offenders has been a cost driver. Substance abuse issues with juveniles, gender-specific treatment issues, and disproportionate minority contact all have been included in the needs of offenders that are drivers of ultimate cost and decision, policy decisions that the Youth Authority has made. Sex offenders, I'd like to just speak very briefly on because they are a growing population in the Youth Authority. Dr. Latessa spoke about this population yesterday. The Oregon Youth Authority, along with the Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association, jointly applied to the Center of Sex Offender Management for a grant at the federal level to, number one, do an analysis of the program and the resources that are available and currently funded in the state of Oregon, number two, to establish consistent protocols for the movement of sex offenders, both between programs and levels of programs that you see on the foam board, and to help us in making resource deployment so that we get the biggest bang for the taxpayer's dollar in working with this population. What we have experienced with sex offenders is they get into the close custody system and they're hard to get out because there is not those next steps laid out. And although they may have progressed in treatment to a point that is commensurate with community risk, there's not the placement in the community that is available. And we are addressing that with both the demand forecast to increase our sex offender aftercare placement capacity in Oregon's communities.
Can I ask you a question about that? On
certainly.
Page 14, the chart that you're showing here, is this the total population of both probation, parole, in custody, out, your total number of offenders, as opposed to those who are just behind closed doors or behind the fence?
Again, you're on page 14, sir?
Yes.
The number that's represented by the chart is a combination of both community and capacity. Both.
So I would think if McLaren in closed custody situations, it's fair to say that it would probably potentially be even higher?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. And we will be speaking that number. Both ballot measures and legislative policy choices have also been cost drivers for the Oregon Youth Authority and the juvenile justice system in Oregon. The establishment of the Oregon Youth Authority through Senate Bill 1 and the requirements, as well as the impact of ballot measure 11 and the transfer of Department of Corrections offenders into our facilities, close custody bed capacity, as well as the Juvenile Crime Prevention Initiative. And this is an important piece, I believe, because the vision of the Juvenile Crime Prevention Initiative was, in fact, to provide dollars to counties and to tribes to identify appropriate interventions for high-risk youth to prevent further penetration into the system. And I again refer to the phone board. The 18,000 of those high-risk offenders that are on the cusp of coming in, the juvenile crime prevention dollars in part targets that population and provides additional access to services to prevent that penetration. Department of Administrative Services, Office of Economic Analysis forecasts the Oregon Youth Authority population, much like you heard Ms. Porter present for the Department of Corrections. And I will just give you some numbers that show where the forecast is going with the Oregon Youth Authority. In April of 06, the agency request budget was based on the forecast increase of 212 beds of close custody population and 101 beds of community capacity, which would be the residential foster care, both on the front end probation and the back end on parole. By the time the governor's recommended budget was developed following the October forecast, that 212 beds had increased to 255, and the community side went down one bed. and it was the recommendation of the Youth Authority in working with the process of developing the governor's budget that if we were given the forecast, we would want to see investments made to restore the continuum of services that was envisioned by Senate Bill 1. And I think many of you were members during the 03 reductions in state government, and those reductions certainly hit juvenile justice in the state of Oregon. Both county capacity on the diversion and juvenile crime prevention side, as well as private providers, our entire shelter care program, and four of our five then recently constructed regional facilities with a capacity of 250 were closed due to those reductions. And the governor's recommended budget does restore capacity at the local level, restores the juvenile department diversion and JCP or juvenile crime prevention basic to the level that it was prior to the reduction and addresses those cost of living increases from that point forward. And it does restore 145 of the beds in close custody. Neither of those numbers come all the way up to the demand forecast. The most recent forecast, which was April of this year, shows yet an additional 87 beds needed in close custody over the 255, which was used in the governor's recommended budget process, and a slight decrease in the community side. At the current time, the Oregon Youth Authority is working with county partners, juvenile department directors, as well as the judicial branch, who you will hear from during public testimony tomorrow, and looking at if those close custody capacity beds were funded, how best to deploy that resource in the state of Oregon, again, to ensure that first and foremost, the public safety interests of its citizens are met, and secondly, that the appropriate reformation in both location and dosages is provided to ensure that we do continue to reduce recidivism in this state. On page 13, this addresses the growing shift in the mental health issues that we have with youth offenders. It shows 2002, which is the first year that we did the gap analysis, and then it shows the two gap analyses that we did from that point following, and it shows that there is an increase both with youth diagnosed with mental health disorders in community and facilities, as well as youth with co-occurring substance abuse and mental health disorders. And that from 2002 to 2005, you'll see a relatively significant increase in both community and our facilities in those two categories. Moving to page 14, this is a recap of the discussion that we had on juvenile sex offenders. This chart in the middle of the page shows the steady increase in the percentage of youth authorities that are represented by our population. In 1990, it was 15%. In 2006, it's doubled to 30%, and that shows a slight decrease from where it has been. But there is some good news around juvenile sex offenders in the state of Oregon that I would be remiss not to share with the committee. First, the Oregon Youth Authority programs that manage juvenile sex offenders are very successful. And national data that has come out of the sex offender management CSUM organization nationally has shown that Oregon juvenile sex offenders that are terminated after completing treatment are convicted of a new sex offense at a rate of 5.3%. So 5.3% of juveniles who complete OYA sex offender treatment programs go on to commit a new sex offense. The national average for that same cohort is between 7 and 13%. So nationally the number is low, but in Oregon it's about half of what we see nationally.
Sure. Just a moment. My apologies for jumping over to this page when I lost track earlier when I asked you that question. The 5.3%, is that over a specific time frame?
Mr. Chair, yes, that is representative of those sex offenders who are terminated from Oregon Youth Authority commitment between the years of 1986 and 2002.
So is it fair to say then that's the recidivism rate over 6 years, or they released it different?
They released it different. Mr. Chair, they were released different times. But that's between 1986 and 2002, they were released, and 5.3 have committed additional sex offense.
But if somebody was released on December 31st, 2001, or January 1st, 1986, is it a three-year recidivism? Is that what you're looking at, similar to what your other cohort is?
Mr. Chair, yes. And this is only looking at that cohort between the years of 1986 to 2002. So the 2002 would have had the 3 years up to 2005.
Thank
if
you.
That makes sense.
Yes. Uh-huh. Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Chair Shields. So what percentage of youth that are in OYA for sexual offense complete the treatment program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, that's a question I don't have a ready answer for, but we will have an answer for you.
Follow-up. Yes, follow-up.
I'm reading from the study, a March 2004 study. You know, it's the numbers you said. It doesn't say that, although in the paragraph above it says juvenile sex offenders who have had the benefit of OYA programs. So of those that were released in that 1986 to 2002 period, is that assuming they all had the benefit of the program to get the 5.3% rate?
Again, the clinical answer to that is yes.
Okay, so I guess what he's asking is, does it include dropouts?
Yeah.
Dropouts of the program.
Drop out of the program.
Drop out of the program.
Well, let me follow up.
Yeah, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess what I'm hoping we could find, and maybe to professional staff, is just of the folks that are in there for sexual offenses, what percentage of them
complete
the program? Because with that, then we can look at the difference between the ones that didn't make it and if the rate is really that high.
Okay. Just some basic outcomes on that.
Mr. Chair, absolutely. We will have that. Turning to page 15, youth offenders with substance abuse issues. I think we heard Dr. Latessa talk yesterday about the fact that untreated substance abuse is a predictor of recidivism. And males with substance abuse are twice as likely to recidivate as those without substance abuse issues. And the agency's risk need assessment and OYA studies confirm that the majority of youth committed to OYA have significant alcohol and drug issues. And you will see the results of the risk need assessment. Offenders in facilities that are either dependent or abuse alcohol and drugs represent 61% of those that are in OYA facilities. And offenders in the community who are either dependent and or abuse alcohol, 49%, almost half of those, fall in that category. And we have worked with Dr. Latessa and our staff in creating both cognitive alcohol and drug treatment programs, and are working with our private providers to address this issue in a way that's a little different than we have historically addressed it. On page 16, female offenders, we've talked a lot about the differences between males and females that are in the juvenile justice system. Let me say that we also talk about the overrepresentation of some of the minority populations in Oregon and nationally in the juvenile justice and public safety systems. Young women and women are underrepresented in terms of services within the public safety system. And we do not advocate that more young women be incarcerated, but we do advocate that more young women have access to gender-specific appropriate services to meet their individual reformation needs. And often because the risk level of young women is not does not compete with young men in terms of commitment to youth correctional facilities, that often relates to a lack of services in the communities as well. So it's one of our priorities in working with community partners, juvenile departments, and private providers to make certain that we address these issues. 13%, as we mentioned, of the total number of offenders that are managed at the youth authority are young women. 9% of those are in close custody. They have unique challenges. They have complex problems, often resulting from trauma, abuse. They often require more psychiatric and psychological assessment, intervention, and individual work. 77% of the females in close custody met the psychiatric requirements for a mental health disorder, and that excludes conduct disorder.
Director Chester, one moment, please, Representative Hannah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bob, I'm going to back up to the alcohol abuse just for a moment. Previous page, we talked about the sex offenders and the success of the treatment. On this page, on alcohol and drug substance abuse issues, doesn't talk about treatment. Is there more about the treatment, or is now the time to ask that question about how successful your treatment is with those folks? Because when I read that the males with the abuse problems are twice as likely to recidivate, you should probably know about the treatment.
There'll be more about that when we talk about our programs.
Okay.
And I'll touch on that when we talk about recidivism as well.
Thank you.
But that is a good question. It's obviously absent. You must not have been too proud at the moment of that outcome. On page 16, 65% of the females in close custody have co-occurring substance abuse and mental health disorders, and that's a huge percentage to deal with both mental health and substance abuse issues. Of the 201 females under community supervision, 75% were diagnosed with a mental health disorder, excluding conduct disorder. So again, these young women have some significant issues that require access to appropriate services that we have a responsibility to make certain are available for them, regardless of where they are.
Sure.
Yes, Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bob, I really appreciate all the work and attention that you give personally and your staff focuses on the gender-specific services. I think my question is, we've known this is an issue since I've come to the legislature. It is now the lifetime of a 16-year-old girl. And so what are the barriers to us getting the services to the girls that they need? Why is it taking so long, basically?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, I would like to acknowledge your support for 16 years for this issue, and I think that a couple things we're seeing. Number one, we're seeing the ability to actually quantify what those issues are through the risk-need assessment process, where before I think we spoke in very general terms about the differences of the treatment and reformation needs of young women. We talked about the fact that they were more emotional, that they tended to be more self-destructive and less outwardly aggressive. But we were never able to quantify what those specific areas that we needed to concentrate to make a difference are. And now we have that, and we are doing that, and we are actually designing programs to meet those needs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
At this time, I'd like to introduce Lonnie Jackson on my right to you. Lonnie is the manager of the Office of Minority Services in the Oregon Youth Authority. He is part of the director's office. He is a nationally recognized leader and trainer and author on the subject of disproportionate minority contact. And I would like to say that the state of Oregon is fortunate not only to have him, but to have been able to hold on to him for as long as we have. So at this point, I'm going to turn the microphone over to Mr. Jackson.
Thanks, Bob. Good afternoon. It's always tough kind of following the boss. Chair Shields, members of the committee, for the record, again, my name is Lonnie Jackson, and I am the manager of Minority Services for the Oregon Youth Authority, and it is really a pleasure to be able to present to you this afternoon what the Oregon Youth Authority is doing to address disproportionate minority contact, DMC, cultural competency, and gangs. I kind of start off by kind of giving a little definition about DMC. Disproportionate contact of ethnic and minority offenders remains a national concern and exists when the proportion of a minority population at a specific stage in the justice system exceeds its proportion in the general population. Now, national research demonstrates that minority youth have been disproportionately referred to and detained in the juvenile justice system and at most related decision points. Now, some of those key decision points include arrest, detention, prosecution, transfer to adult court, commitment to secure facilities. Now, in Oregon, minority youth are overrepresented at every decision point, and the problem is increasing over time. One good thing is that Oregon's juvenile justice community continues to be recognized nationally for its leadership and coordination in efforts to reduce DMC and gang intervention services. I'm kind of refer you to the chart. I'm looking at OIA and state juvenile population age 10 to 17, race, ethnicity by status. Again, I think this is a good chart that kind of shows the ethnicity breakdown by percentages in terms of looking at youth offenders in close custody, DOC offenders in close custody, and youth offenders on parole and probation in comparison with Oregon youth age 10 to 17. You might notice that there is a difference in terms of a higher percentage of DOC offenders, particularly with African American and Hispanics in OYA custody. A few other points I'd like to make. Minority youth are overrepresented in the OYA population by 8% compared to Oregon's overall age 10 to 17 population. Minority youth are overrepresented in OYA's close custody population. African American youth have the greatest disproportionate confinement. Recent statewide trends show Latino youth as Oregon's largest at-risk youth population. What I'd like to share right now is just some of the leadership, partnership, and collaborative efforts OYA is making to address some of these issues. And some of the information I'm about to share is not in your binders, by the way.
Just a moment, Mr. Jackson.
Mr. Jackson, I'm not sure I understand what's being said there about the thing. Are there huge numbers of white kids committing these crimes that are not going in, and every black kid who commits a crime is going in, these kids actually committing the crimes? Or when you say disproportion, is it disproportion on the crimes they're committing, or if you could help me there?
Chair Shields, Representative Barker, I think what I'm saying when I refer to DMC, minority of representation, if you look at African-American males, for example, I think we have a statewide population of maybe 1.62%, but I think in OYA close custody with youth offenders, we have about an 8% population of African-American youth in our close custody system.
I understand, but are they committing the crimes? And I mean, if white people are white kids are underrepresented, is it because they're committing the crimes and getting off the hook, or?
Again, Representative Chills, Representative Baker, to be committed, of course, the Youth Authority, you are committing crimes to be committed. I think the issue that we are looking at is that there's a number of youth of color, in particular African-American youth and Hispanic youth, that are overrepresented in relation to their numbers in the community.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Again, I'd like to talk a little bit about some of those leadership and collaborative efforts the Youth Authority is underway in addressing some of these issues. OYA provides statewide leadership and efforts to address minority overrepresentation, including co-sponsoring each governor's summit on minority overrepresentation in the juvenile justice system. I've had the honor of chairing each governor's summit planning committee each year. We have established community partnerships to coordinate resources, including creating a specialized transition process for minority youth and establishing specialized multidisciplinary teams to identify appropriate placements and services for minority youth. We have finalized agreements with six of Oregon's federally recognized tribes and facilitate the SB 770 government-to-government public safety cluster meetings of state and tribal public safety officials. OYA participates in community groups in Portland, Multnomah County, and Central Eastern Oregon, which focuses on gangs and services to minority youth. We have strengthened our relationships with minority communities by revitalizing minority advisory committees. These are Native American, Hispanic, and African American advisory committees. These community advisory committees help to ensure that our services, policies, procedures, etc., are sensitive to and meeting the needs of the diverse youth population that we serve. Now, the Youth Authority has an unwavering commitment to cultural competency and diversity, which begins with outstanding commitment by our director, Bob Jester. We participate in ensuring culturally competent and gender-specific services throughout Oregon's youth services process through the Partners for Children and Families process and Multnomah County's African American and Latino Communities of Color partnerships. We have demonstrated leadership through our array of minority youth services and in our advocacy to address the issue through evidence-based and best practices in facilities and community programs. What I would like to do now is, again, touch a little bit more about how OYA ensures access to appropriate services for minority youth. Again, we have a big commitment to make sure youth are receiving appropriate services in our custody. We also facilitate culturally specific and multicultural support groups in our closed custody facilities. We provide training for staff and community contracted providers, as well as other community groups on cultural competency, diversity, gang awareness, and gang intervention strategies. We provide transition services that assist youth in community reentry from closed custody. Services are culturally specific, language appropriate, and individualized. I'm going to focus now a little bit about the issue of youth gangs, which is now affecting small towns and rural areas in Oregon and continues to be a major concern in urban areas. OYA provides a Yes.
Before we go on, he talked about the reentry programs, particularly for people of color, and my assistant Renee Ward has been involved with doing some of that work. But I was hoping maybe you could just, rather than just saying the word, you know, maybe paint a picture of what happens just for a moment or two for a young person of color, so that you're ensuring that they do get culturally competent services, and any speculation or data you might have on how that affects their recidivism versus, you know, European American kids or others.
Right. Thank you, Chair Chills. Yeah, we have a specialized minority youth transition program, which again helps to ensure youth are receiving, again, culturally specific, individualized, language appropriate services. We have a transition specialist which works with our OYA field parole and probation offices, particularly the parole officers, and establishing, you know, assessments, doing the case planning, and really looking to ensure that we're meeting the needs of youth, of course, through our assessments and other means of youth once they reenter the community. Through this process, we've also been able to contract with a number of providers to provide a wide array of services once youth re-enter the community. Those services could be mental health services, drug and alcohol, mentorship type services, providing assistance with youth in terms of employment, educational opportunities. And again, many of the providers we contract with are really culturally sensitive to youth that they work with. It's really intensive type of a transition process. We try to get youth involved with referrals 90 days prior to them returning to the community is our goal. And again, it's real intensive in terms of monitoring, in terms of supervision. But a lot of it is also very relationship orientated, as a lot of our youth are really involved with a lot of our programs within our close custody facilities. In terms of recidivism rates, the only one I can probably give you right now in terms of for a comparison is our 2001, maybe 2003 kind of recidivism rates, which is looking at everyone, Caucasian youth, as well as all the overrepresented minorities in our custody. And if you could hold on for just a second, I can get you that information. Look it up here. Got a feeling that question may come up. Okay, OYA recidivism rates for overrepresented minorities varies by status. OYA did a 36-month recidivism by race, ethnicity, and status for the fiscal year 2001 through 2003, and this is just pulled all together. For probation youth, with Caucasian youth, recidivism was 26%. Overrepresented minorities was 38%. With parole, it was 35%. Overrepresented minorities, 36, so they were pretty close, and it was a slight increase for the DOC youth. 15% Caucasian, 19% overrepresented. We're really kind of in the process now of really focusing in on how we can do an even greater job of really evaluating how effective we're doing in relation to tracking effectiveness and recidivism for youth that have been involved with the transition program.
So you're looking at whether or not these services have that kind of effect. And I would think that probably at the end of the day, young people would be more likely to participate in cognitive behavioral therapy treatment if they got these kinds of, people to assist them. But I'd be interested in finding out those results as time goes.
And we're definitely looking forward, Chair Chills, definitely looking forward to sharing that information. And many of the providers actually began their services prior to the youth, returning to the community, so they have the opportunity to really find out who will be providing services, when it's going to happen, and really be part of that whole case planning process.
Great. Please continue.
Okay. In relation again to youth gangs, OYA provides a continuum again of best practice programs and services. We have Street Smarts, which is a gang intervention youth empowerment curriculum, which is provided to youth in close custody facilities. We have gang intervention services, which are provided again through youth transition programs. We utilize volunteers and mentors to assist youth in close custody. We have a tattoo removal program, which utilizes a laser machine to remove tattoos. It also assists youth in obtaining employment and educational opportunities and helps to reduce further unwanted gang identification. Community outreach activities include assisting groups across the state in employing gang intervention strategies. OYA funds county-based gang intervention and prevention services with both ongoing and one-time funding. Now, this has just been a quick overview of just some of the work and efforts and leadership OYA is providing in addressing disproportionate minority contact, cultural competency, and gangs. At this time, I'm available for any questions, or if there are not any questions, I again appreciate the opportunity to share this information with this committee.
Questions?
Go ahead. Just a cursory one, Mr. Jackson, and I know you must get asked this question a lot, but the tattoo removal machine, does that hurt as much as when the kids are getting the tattoos?
Well, I haven't had the opportunity to get a tattoo removed because I don't have any, but I hear that it can be kind of painful process. And usually it requires more than one process to really, get the tattoo removed. And we've been fortunate that we've had doctors who have volunteered their time to actually come in and facilitate the machine and the operation of it. And really started off as a real innovative project with the Oregon Psychiatric Association.
And just to follow up, Mr. Chair, I want to tell you I really appreciate your presentation document there, because you don't know how many times I've sat at a table with all the sticky notes. And I'm with you. That's how I do it. I like that. I like that organizational capacity right there.
And one thing I like to share, too, with the committee is that that laser machine has been donated to the Youth Authority. So it is, ours that we use, And, again, youth that really go through that process are youth that are making progress in their treatment. You don't just, go through it because you raise your hand and say, I want to get my tattoo removed. That's because you're being amenable to treatment, you're showing a desire to change, you don't want to have any further gang involvement when you get out, so there's a process for that. And so again, I really thank the committee for taking time to hear about a lot of the work, and again, want to commend our director, because to make all this happen, you have to have that leadership at the top.
Before you step away, Mr. Jackson, I just had two questions.
Okay.
I'm not sure who would be the best for. So on the gang intervention services... The gang intervention services, I presume, are part of your calculation on whether or not you're meeting your SB 267 requirements.
Right.
And so you'll report more on that when we have our Senate Bill 267 day.
Yeah, and Chair Chills, as I said, share real briefly, I think the Youth Authority is probably the only juvenile correctional agency in the country that actually does gang intervention in terms of really have a curriculum specific to the unique needs of working with gang-involved youth.
Okay. And then my last question is on page 17, as you look at the youth offenders close custody, DOC offenders close custody, 8% for African Americans in one, 14% in the other. Can you make any speculation or comment on what's going on there?
Again, I just for me, it just shows again that we have challenges, in terms of youth, whether they're, you know, youth that are being committed to the adult system or, you know, youth offenders that are just coming to, you know, our custody, along lines of arrest, you know, that are some youth that are getting arrested and getting charged with Measure 11 crimes. And it's real hard to pinpoint, you know, exactly what's leading to where we have a higher percentage of, you know, DOC commitments. But that's something I'd like to maybe follow up on and kind of come back to this committee.
Great.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Shields, just to make a comment on your question as well, Dr. Latessa yesterday spoke of individual youth responsivity and their ability to actually address some of the issues that confront them. And when Representative Barker asked, I think, a very good question about, you know, does this mean that, you know, Caucasian youth who are committing crimes are, you know, not getting held accountable. I don't think that that's correct either. I think that what we see in the disproportionate minority contact is that there is a number of decision points that people make decisions around where youth or adults are going to go in regards to systems. And if there are resources on the right or the left-hand side, there's a choice for the police officer, the parent, the school, the judge, the juvenile department worker, the probation parole officer to make. And if there aren't choices, then the pathway is more defined. And, you know, we have a no-decline acceptance policy in our youth correctional facilities. And I think that is really the issue that we talk about when we talk about both young women in terms of affording a continuum of services and access for them, as well as youth of color, that we need to have appropriate services and accesses for them so that they do not penetrate further into the state side of that continuum. But I think your question was very well placed.
Representative Hennett.
Thank you, Chair Shields. Bob, your comment brings about a question in my mind then. If we looked at the chart as presented on page 17 and you said, okay, there are a number of different points of contact, and those variables, sort of your way in the scale on either side, what if you eliminated that and you built that chart around Measure 11 offenders, where there really were very few variables? What would that chart look like then?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, I'm not certain what it would look like then. In terms of the Measure 11 commitment, we know that the disproportionate minority confinement of offenders in Oregon Youth Authority increases on the DOC side from the OIA side, and whether that is the severity of the offense or the way they're charged. Because we know through history that there are some offenders who commit Measure 11 offenses and they're offered the opportunity to plead to a lesser offense, and the lesser offense provides something other than a Measure 11 sentence. And there are some offenders that are not afforded that. And I think, again, this has to do with public perception, and I think it has to do with where we have alternatives and options. But more important to me is the fact that before we get to the Measure 11 offense, what are the options and alternatives in communities that folks have to address the issues? I mean, we've talked about the criminogenic risk factors. Where are the options and alternatives locally to deal with those criminogenic risk factors before we get to the Measure 11 offense? And I think that's much of the work that Mr. Jackson and others who have mobilized in minority communities, along with our advocates for gender-specific services, are at, is before that point. It's in the prevention side that we want to make those investments.
Follow up.
Thank you, and I appreciate your comments. If it wasn't, I mean, if the numbers are available, it would be interesting for me to see what it looks like if you just ran the same chart with Measure 11 offense.
We can absolutely get that for you, sir.
Thank you.
Are you clear what he's looking for?
Yes.
Okay. Please continue.
At this time, I would like to have Debbie Rios join me. And Ms. Rios is our clinical expert and is responsible in large part for the implementation of not only our evidence-based practices, but has kind of been the shepherd of the agency as we have moved from an agency of anecdotal outcome to an actual agency of measuring almost everything. And so Ms. Rios is here to participate in the next presentation, which is the OIA system of performance measurements. And during the overview, we touched on the fact that we really have six different strategies that we deploy in terms of measuring the effectiveness of the services that the Oregon Youth Authority provides. One of those is the performance-based standards, and this is a national project that looks at over 100 areas of safety, order, security, health, mental health programming, and reintegration from youth who are in facilities. And this is a program that we do every 6 months. A survey and measurement goes to a national database. We compare each facility not only against itself but against the facilities nationally to see how we are doing in these 100 areas. Safety and security reviews, both the Oregon Youth Authority field community side as well as our facility side, has teams that go out and do safety and security reviews both in our offices and community and our facilities, make sure that we're adhering to our policies and standards. These are led by our safety officer. We use the correctional program checklist, the CPC, that you heard Dr. Lacoste refer to yesterday. All of our units, individual housing units in the Oregon Youth Authority, have been rated by the CPC, as well as all of our contract providers have been rated by the CPC. Quality assurance and continuous quality improvement. We have a team that represents both local folks as well as statewide folks that look at developing plans wherever we have an area that is showing problematic results on any of the instruments that we use. And they then engage in this quality improvement project to bring that particular area up to standard. The statewide juvenile justice recidivism, Oregon Youth Authority works with the 36 local county juvenile departments in measuring the effectiveness of programs at the local level for those youth on probation to counties, and I'll speak briefly about that. It's not one of our key performance measurements, but I think it's important to you, the members that make decisions about funding, to see that Oregon is, by and large, a successful juvenile justice system. And kind of granddaddy of these, the key performance measures that the Oregon Youth Authority has. We have 15 of those. Representative Hannah sat through our presentation last session, showed great patience in listening to us, and gave us a great deal of guidance. We revised 11 of those that we presented last time. 11 are new. And so this is the first time we'll be presenting data on those 11. The key performance measures, which I'd now like to talk about, they all reflect the mission and values of the Oregon Youth Authority. I'm speaking from page 20 in your book. The key performance measures focus on the areas of public safety, youth reformation, accountability, and safe environments, both in the community and facilities for both our staff and our youth offenders. On page 21, in public safety, Oregon Youth Authority has four key performance measures that monitor the efforts to enhance public safety. These look at parole recidivism. This look at probation recidivism, looks at completed escapes, and it looks at runaways. On page 22, I'd like to talk about the county recidivism measure. And this measure was adopted by Oregon Youth Authority, working with the Juvenile Department Directors Association and local governments to measure the effectiveness of county programs that have youth on probation. So these are youth that have not yet entered the state system, are being managed and served at the local level. And the measurement begins when a youth is first referred to a county juvenile department, and then it tracks that youth out 12 months. And a recidivism measure would be either a new referral for a misdemeanor or a felony. So we start when the youth is first referred. We go out 12 months. We look back. If there's been a new felony or misdemeanor referral to the juvenile department, we consider that recidivism. Some general statements. The number of juvenile offenders per year is declining in Oregon. The juvenile justice recidivism rate that I just described has continued to decrease over the past 11 years that we have measured it. And it has decreased from 38% to 32% over the 11-year period. And it's been holding pretty steady at about 32% for the past 4 years. Chart at the bottom left-hand side of the page shows you the year 1995 when we started collecting the data. The number of youth that was in the cohort was 22,000 working across 12 months. The number of offenders who recidivated were 8,500, and the percentage was 38.1. You look down to the bottom, the latest collected data in 2005, that number has decreased to 17,000 plus. The number who have recidivated is approximately 5,500, and the rate is 31.5. The target that we have established for this recidivism measurement has been 30. So we're headed in the right direction. We continue to work with counties. A piece of what you will hear during public testimony has been the difficulties that counties have faced with reduction in resources, both with the state's recession in 2003 and our reduction of juvenile crime prevention basic dollars as well as diversion dollars, and now counties are faced with ONC potential shortages, are very concerned about the ability to continue this downward trend of recidivism for youth. Again, the 18,000 that they're managing that are not being managed by the state, and holding those youth without additional law violations. On page 23, recidivism measure, this is really the ultimate goal of the program that you are reviewing the budget. The ultimate goal is that we have no new crime committed by youth that are placed in the custody of the Oregon Youth Authority, and no new crime by youth that are served by dollars that the Youth Authority is passing through to counties, either through grants and or contracting for services. That's the goal. We don't want youth to commit additional law violations. And we measure that, which you will see on page 24. We first look at youth who have been paroled from a youth correctional facility. So these are youth offenders committed by the juvenile court to OYA as juveniles. They have completed a program and or been paroled for the first time in the community. The clock starts. We look out 12 months, 24 months, and 36 months, and we see if there is either a referral or an adjudication on a felony law violation. And the felony benchmark is set by the legislature. Two sessions ago, we were asked to have a comparable measure as DOC so that when this committee looked at the two budgets and the two agencies, we were talking apples to apples. Many jurisdictions look at both misdemeanor referrals as well as felonies, which is what the county statewide recidivism data looks at. Looks at misdemeanors and felonies. The KPM for the Oregon Youth Authority only looks at felonies. If you look at the top line under KPM 12, I'm looking at page 24. In 01, there were 412 youth that were placed in the community for the first time from our youth correctional facilities. 12 months out, 13.3% had been either adjudicated and or found guilty of a new felony law violation. 24 months is 25.5, and 36 months it is 35.7. This number has steadily decreased over the years. The latest data we have, which is only 1 year going back, is in 05. 313 youth were placed on parole for the first time. 12 months out, 8.9 of those youth had committed a felony law violation or had a referral to juvenile court for a felony. The target for this is 8. after 12 months, it is 24 for 24 months, and 34 for 36 months. The probation measurement, which is KPM.
Representative has a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This looks like really good news when you look at fiscal year 04 to 05, the reduction at the 12-month point from 10.4 to 8.9. But since the crime rate has been going down also at the same time, is this decrease is this an improvement on what generally is a reduction in crime, or does it just parallel that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nathanson, those would be the two options. I suppose the third would be that the good work the Youth Authority is doing is actually decrease the crime rate, and the crime rate is reflective of the fact that there's less recidivism, both on the DOC side and the Oregon Youth Authority side. And I say that not facetiously, but because we are talking about the highest risk youth and adults from both DOC and OYA that are reentering communities and have the opportunity to commit an additional law violation.
Do you happen to know what the difference is offhand, the reduction in the crime rate between those 2 years?
We can certainly get that for you. I don't have the crime rate.
It's an interesting issue because from what I've been asked, can I do one follow-up? Thank you. What I've been asking in a couple of different venues is, to what extent does the Oregon experience mirror the national experience? And there are crime stats, and then there are also statistics on there's the victimization survey, and I'm really trying to figure out whether the good work, evidence-based treatment, for example, that's done in Oregon or in other states, whether that is finally, we're seeing the benefits of it, you know, the fruits of the labors, if you will, or whether there are other things impacting the results that we're seeing in raw numbers.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that your line of thinking, your question is very astute. I think it is very difficult to separate out the cause and effect because so many states now are engaged in some level of evidence-based practice. During the overview, we were asked for some comparison. How does Oregon look compared nationally? And the closest state, both in terms of physical proximity and in terms of measurement, is the state of Washington. And the state of Washington measures recidivism rate as a new felony adjudication and or conviction. And their measurement is 18 months out. So it would be somewhere between our 12 and our 24. No one does it the same way. But their recidivism rate is 40%. So there's a significant difference between the outcome of those offenders in Oregon and those offenders in the state of Washington. And for recidivism, and this is where why it is difficult to do comparisons between states, that there are really four variables in recidivism. You know, first you need to define the group that you're going to look at, and this is a group that are being paroled from our facilities. So the definition of who's in our facilities is somewhat different than other states. The second is what the event is going to be that's going to be considered a recidivating event. Is it a felony? Is it a misdemeanor? Is it a conviction? Is it an arrest? Is it a detention? Different states define it differently. And then there's the point that you start the clock and the point that you stop the clock. We start the clock when the parolee hits the street in the community because we think that's the opportunity to commit the law violation. We look back 12, 24, 36. Washington looks back 18. So getting all four of those variables to sync in 50 states is very difficult to get a direct comparison. But we do have a national recidivism study.
And just a moment. Representative Kremel, would you like to join us at the dais to ask some questions? Okay. More than welcome. We have actually got a chair with Senator Winters being out. So anytime you're interested, please continue.
The probation KPM 13 These are youth that are moving from that 18,000 into the first box, which is the OYA probation services. And we start the clock when the youth is actually committed to our legal custody, because they remain in the community, and we believe that they continue to have access to commit a law violation. So from the day of commitment, the clock starts, again, the definition being a felony law violation and or referral. We look back 12, 24, 36 months, and similar data, 01, 677 youth were placed on probation during that fiscal year. 14.2 had a new felony. 24 months, it was 22.9, and 31% after 36 months. Bottom line, when you look at 05, 447, 12 months out, 9.6. Our target is 9, 17, and 24, respectively, for that cohort. We plan on continuing actually steepening that line a bit. We were asked during the overview.
Just a moment, Director Jessup. Representative Penner.
Bob, thank you. Thank you, Chair Shields. If the clock starts when they come into your custody under probation services, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. What's the average length of probation? I mean, let me follow up just a moment. Because, I mean, I'm thinking about this as you're saying that, and I'm thinking, if the clock starts when they're in probation, so this first year number looks pretty low because they're under active probation services. If the average length of probation is 10 months, well, 10 out of the first 12 months, they're meeting somebody, and after that, the number jumps because it goes away. So what is the average?
Chair, Representative Hanna, the average time that youth are in residential programs is generally 9 to 12 months. And so I think you have an accurate perception in that many times these youth are being supervised in a community program. It's not a locked program, and the youth can run from the program, but they are under that supervision. When we made the decision to look at probation and when to begin the clock in terms of looking at recidivism, we looked at, you know, they're in the community, they have the opportunity to commit crimes, just as youth that are on parole, when they go into the community, they have that same
opportunity. Excuse me real quick. Ms. Rios, could you just identify yourself for the record?
Certainly. My name is Debbie Rios, and I'm with the program office, and I work in the Evidence-Based Practices
Sorry.
Initiative.
So please continue. I didn't interrupt too badly.
So I think when we look at the recidivism, we really want to track it over periods of time. Some states only look at this for a 12-month period of time when youth are in supervision. We're looking at it in 12 and 24 and 36 months, and we just started evaluating that within the last 5 years. So in some of our studies, we are looking out further as well.
Well, I appreciate that answer, and I think I better understand it. I mean, if you just look at the numbers and you say to yourself, why does it double after 12 months? I mean, in my mind, it was simply probation had to be having a profound effect. Yes, you can run away from it. Yes, you can. You're still in the community and can commit a crime, but just, I mean, my mind says if you're going to go meet with an authority figure, you're probably less likely to do that, and it might, I mean, the numbers might actually indicate that if someone's under probation services and receiving that attention necessary, otherwise I'm not sure why it, you know, virtually doubles after that time period runs out.
Chair, Representative Hanna, when we look at the fiscal year of 04, the recidivism rate is 9 for the first 12 months, and then it's 17.6 for the 24 months. So it's about the same rate of recidivism of, you know, 1%, less than 1% per month.
Okay.
that make sense?
No, that doesn't make sense to me.
Because you're counting, it's cumulative numbers, so you're counting all the past people as well, so.
You're counting the same people twice in the second 12 months?
Yeah, I'll let you give it.
Okay, because it was 9% for 12 months and it's 17.6 for 24.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, I think that the part of the answer to your question is the longer the exposure for committing a law violation, the greater the opportunity and propensity an offender has to commit a law violation. So it about doubles and from 12 to 24, and there's another 50% as you look at the number up to 36.
Thank you.
So, I mean, if I could maybe jump in, if you assume that there were 100 people in that cohort, 9 would recidivate at the year mark, and then 17 would, 0.6 would recidivate at the 2-year mark, and then you'd presume that maybe another 8 or 9 would recidivate in that third year.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
I understand that. I just as a follow-up, my thought is simply this, and maybe I'm not saying it right, but if you took 100 people in that cohort and you said, all right, 9 did after the first year, and it's been 17.6 after 2 years, what if you took another study group and you started measuring 12 months after they left probation? Would it be 17.6?
I see, after, as opposed to when the clock starts ticking at the beginning of probation?
Right.
Well, I'll let you answer. I mean, I have speculation. But.
Well, I think it is, Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, I think it is somewhat speculative. We tried to use actually the most conservative, which was from the time that they are in our custody and actually probably most likely to commit that law violation because they haven't yet benefited from the services that we are providing. They have that highest risk, and in theory, as those services are provided and supervision takes hold and they begin to get more grounded and work in school, that their likelihood would lessen. And I think nationally, data would indicate that that is correct. But the longer you look, the higher recidivism will always be because there is a greater opportunity as you go out longitudinally for that event to occur. And 36 months nationally, that is the longest that a juvenile justice agency is looking. We have the ability to look further.
Let me add something. Okay. I think perhaps what Representative Hanna is getting at is that, and what I've seen in recidivism, is the longer you're out, you know, the recidivism curve kind of flattens out over time. Maybe that's what you're getting at.
And as a follow-up, Chair Shields, thank you, and I won't beat this to death, I promise. But, you know, I said this before, sometimes it appears to me that there's a minimum amount of time you want to deal with somebody. In other words, if you took 12 months and you said only 9% of the people under probation were recidivating, and you said, well, what if we could have them in parole for 24 months instead of 12 months? Could we keep the number to 9%? Or is it just the length of time that they've been out that raises the number? Does the parole have the effect of mitigating recidivism? I mean, if we could measure that and say parole mitigates recidivism, we'd probably keep them on parole longer if we could actually prove that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, I think speculation on my part, we will take a look at it and try to have some more definitive both numbers and answer for your question. But the longer that we provide services, we believe that there's a greater impact on the offender.
But at the same time, perhaps what Dr. Latessa was suggesting is that if you have a low-risk offender and you keep them on intensive supervision and making them jump through a lot of hoops that may or not be associated with their service needs, that you could end up tripping them up and make it more difficult.
Mr. Chair, I agree. The last just piece of information, and I know we're out of time, is we were asked during the overview for a comparison for how the DOC offenders that we manage do when they're released to the community. So the bottom, although this is not a KPM for the Oregon Youth Authority, DOC release from OYA youth correctional facilities to post-prison supervision, which would be done by community corrections at the county level. We pooled the offenders released between the fiscal year 101 through 103, and that was 178 offenders that were released, and 12 months out, the felony rate was 4.5, and 24 months out is 12.4, and 36 months out is 16.3. So this is a group that by this data does very well in our programs.
Any questions before we close? I think I'll pass it off to the LFO staff and they can update us on what our schedule is going to be. Robin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The intention is to have public testimony on this Oregon Youth Authority budget tomorrow. Presentation again on Thursday, and then again starting Monday of next week. So we hope to be able to march a piece through the rest of it. But the public testimony will be tomorrow, because that's what initially had gone out in terms of information, and they didn't want to make people change their schedules.
Great. Thank you very much. Nice job.
Thank
appreciate you.
You
coming to testify.
Thanks.
Thanks.